So this is actually the fifth in our series on the Derech HaPsak of various chief rabbis, how chief rabbis approached and handled halachic issues. We had our first mini series of three, and now we're in the second of this mini series of three. Rabbi Ziering spoke last week. Last week was Rav Boren or Rav Uziel. Last week was Rav Uziel, so the next week is going to be Rav Gorin, and that'll wrap up the current mini-series. This week we have Rav Shapira, or as I put it at the top of the sheet, his full title, Rav Avram Elkanah Kahana Shapira. So the truth is I picked him largely because I didn't know a whole lot about him, and I was fascinated by what he did at the period of the disengagement, where he said that you're not allowed to follow the instructions to evacuate Jewish communities. He was very takiv, he was very strong, and I wanted to know more about this Rav Shapira. Really, the strength stands out. Whenever you look at anybody's description,
you're talking about?
Well, no, he was too young at Yamit. Ritzvi Yehuda was Yamit.
Oh.
He was Talmid of Ritzvi Yehuda. This is at the disengagement from Asa. Everybody who talks about Rav Shapira talks about his strength. That's like one of the principal features. You take a look on your sheet at the first source on the sheet. This is from a hesped that appears on YU Torah from Rabbi Yitzhak Steinberg. He says, Rav Shapira was the Oz HaTorah, his might and the strength he had through the Torah he learned. In Rav Shapira, we felt his strength in Torah was so powerful, so strong, that he wasn't afraid of anything. His psak halacha was clear and cut. Lo saguru mipnei ish, he wasn't afraid of people around him, of those who were usually more appreciative of him, of his circles, and so on. And he wasn't afraid of anyone from the outer circles, from those, from politicians, those who control the country. Not afraid of the inner circle, not afraid of the outer circle. You don't like him? That's too bad. He wasn't afraid of them at all. And that fearlessness, like I said, stands out in the comments you see about him. And so the question is, okay, but what was he fearless for? Right? I know people who are fearless for the sake of being fearless. Right? They're just going to take a stand on whatever the issue is. They're going to take a stand. That's not really what we're interested in. What were his set of values? What was it that drove him? So I wouldn't quite call this Derech HaPsak in the sense of how did he approach a particular halachic issue that came in front of him, but how did he think? What was it that he valued that was important to him, and how was it expressed in his psak? So what we're going to do...
Was he a chief rabbi?
Yes, all of these are chief rabbis. They have to be chief rabbis in order to qualify for this series. We'll talk about what years, but basically it's the 80s. We'll see.
When was he a chief rabbi?
You'll see. We'll get there. One site that I found at the end of my preparation for this, and I put the link on here because it's very useful, is number two. The website is Mari Kohen, and it's specifically dedicated to the Torah of Rav Shapira. Unfortunately, as you can tell from the link, it's a JavaScript link, and it's very bulky. Sometimes the page shows up blank, and sometimes the page shows up with articles. And sometimes you click on the link for an article, and nothing shows up. It's hit or miss, which is very frustrating when you're putting together a source sheet, and you know where you saw something, but you can't get the page to load. Not that that happened too much, but it's still it has very good resources on the website. So what I want to do is give first his background, his biography, who he interacted, what his identity was, a little bit about his personality, and then talk about three elements that he really emphasized in his psak. One that we'll talk about is Mesorah. Tradition is extremely important to him. Second is Eretz Yisrael, and this is not order of priority, but this is just the way that I built the shiur. Eretz Yisrael, as you will see. And then third, if we have time for it at the end, he had creative twists that show up in his thinking. And the case that I'm going to give you as the example here will be his approach to a particular question regarding the status of Ethiopian Jews who had a bris milah in Ethiopia. And you'll see, God willing, we get there, what that's about. But let's go back first to his biography. His family was an old Yerushalmi family. He is sixth generation from the Talmidei Hagra, the students of the Vilna Gaon who arrived in Eretz Yisrael. That's where his family comes from. I found three different birth dates on different websites, at least two of which should know what they're talking about. meaning the official chief rabbinate website, at www.gov.il, lists him as being born on the 23rd of Iyar in 1910. The Merkaz Harav website, which I would also expect would know something, given that he was a Ram there or a Rosh Hashiva there for over 60 years, they say the 14th of Iyar instead of the 23rd, and they say 1914 instead of 1910. And then Wikipedia, who knows where they got it from, splits the difference and has the 14th of the year 1911. So he's born somewhere between 1910 and 1914. I feel fairly comfortable saying that. He's born in the month of Iyar. I feel comfortable saying that. And beyond that, I don't know. I don't understand why we have different dates. Okay. He learns in, he's born in Yerushalayim. He learns in the Talmud Torah called Eitz Chaim, which was in the Churva Shul in Yerushalayim. Then Yeshivat Tiferet Zvi. And then when the Chevron Yeshiva moves in 1929, he goes there to learn under Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein and Rav Yechezkel Sarna. So he's part of that generation of Talmidei Chachamim who were trained in the Chevron Yeshiva in those days. It's a funny story in number three here from his bio on the Merkaz Harav website, which is a great bio. There's a lot of really good information there. But take a look. Be'echad mi'amav ha'rishonim b'shivat Chevron. One of his first days in Chevron. Tol k'dei shir l'klal ha'yeshiva shal ha'gon Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein zatzal. Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein is giving the shir klali to the yeshiva as a whole. Hiksha kusha atzuma amahalah ha'shir. He asked a great question against the whole flow of the shir. So Agon Rav Epstein Zatzal Hivsikas Hashir LaKamishniyot. Rav Epstein stops for a few seconds. Chashav al advarim, thinks about it. Lachem again Himshach Bashir Kilu Huksha Davar, and then he keeps right on going. Doesn't answer the question. Pauses and keeps going. B'tchilat Hashir HaKlali Abba, beginning of the next Shir HaKlali, Shal Hagon Rav Moshe Mordechai Zatzal. Eifal HaKatan Sheikshaz HaKusha B'Shir HaKodim. He asks, where's the little one who asked the question in the previous Shir? They add in parentheses that Rav Shapira was not only young back in the day, but he was also short. Right? How young he was will depend again on which date he was born. He was either 19 years old or 15 years old. But either way, apparently he was short. So Rav Epstein asks, where's the little guy? Lachar Shem Mitzah, after he found him, Himshech Bashir Shekulo Nasov Saviva Kusha Shehiksha Bashir HaKodim. He builds the entire Shir HaKali around Rav Shapira's question that he'd asked during the previous Shir. And at that point, the word goes out, this is really something. According to the Merkaz website, at the age of 12, he published his first sefer, so he may have been 16. It's on Darchei HaKinyanim, how Kinyan works in Halacha. He marries his wife, Penina, in 1945. It's a shidduch arranged by Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, with whom he was close. There was some relationship with the Cook family in general for her, but I'm not clear on the specifics. They had four sons. I'm not aware of daughters, but they had four sons. One of them is Shlomo. The others will go into the Rabbanus, Rav Yaakov, Rav Shmuel, and Rav Ben Zion and Shapira. After he gets married, they invite him to teach in Merkaz Harav. So in 1945, he starts as a Ram in Merkaz Harav. He has remarkable connections with great Talmidei Chachamim in those early years. Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer published Rav Shapira's Ha'aros on his Eben Ha'azel. Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer wrote the Eben Ha'azel on the Rambam's Mishneh Torah. So when you look in the Mishneh Torah, in the Eben Ha'azel, if you look at Hilchos Beis HaMechira, Hilchos Klei HaMikdash, and Hilchos Bias Mikdash, all Beis HaMikdash oriented areas of Halacha, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer includes the notes by Rav Shapira, and he calls him Yedidi Harav Hagon Hanale Moreinu Harav Avram Shapira Sheyechya Mitzuyanei Yeshivat Chevron. From the real standouts of Yeshivat Chevron. Now, what makes this so remarkable is that at this point, Rav Shapira is in his 20s, and Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer is in his late 60s. And yet he addresses him with that respect and includes his comments within his sefer. Obviously that tells you as much about Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer as it does about Rav Shapira, that he was willing to do that. But it also tells you the type of Torah that Rav Shapira is producing from a very young age. Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, Chief Rabbi of Yerushalayim, asked him to put his Ha'aros in writing on Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank's ideas, and there's an exchange found in the Milchas Avram. The Milchas Avram is the main sefer for the Lamdus of Rav Shapira. Sefira. It's four volumes. You can get it on Otzer Chachma. So in the second volume, in the beginning of the second volume, you find the exchange of letters between Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank and Rav Shapira on the topic of the mitzvah of Arla. He also had an exchange of letters with the Chazon Ish. And the Chazon Ish sent him his new sefer to see, and he wrote back to him, and he gave him his haros, and those appear also in the second volume of Minchas Avram. The story goes, according to the Merkaz Arav website, take it with a grain of salt perhaps, but according to the Merkaz Arav website, the Chazon Ish tried to convince Rav Shapira to come teach in Panovich, and he refused. But then when Rav Tzvi Yehuda asked him to come teach in Merkaz Arav, he said yes. So, I don't know. I'm not sure. They don't give you a citation for the story, but I don't know. Rav Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik apparently was close with him as well. The story goes that Rav Shapira was close with Rav Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, the Grizz, who was an anti-Tzionim, basically. And at the wedding of the Grizz's son, at the Chassan's Tish, he started asking questions about the Chassan's Dvar Torah. And the crowd didn't like it very much. They didn't appreciate it. But he kept on going, and the Grizz said, let him be, and let me hear what he's asking. And he starts debating with him about the questions that he's asking. There are many more exchanges with leading Rabbanim of the day that are published in the second Chelek, the second volume of Minchas Avram. He also corresponded with Rav Moshe Feinstein, who in Igros Moshe Ben Ezer, Chelek Aleph, Tshuva Chav Dalet, they're dealing with the question of a woman who had been married to a Kohen, and then had allegedly been with a non-Jew. And the question of, could she go back to her husband, the Kohen? So Rav Moshe is consulted by Rav Shapira. And he writes back to him, V'das kvotaras harav laheter, kasher herich betuv tam. He says, Your Honor already said, he's writing to Rav Shapira, who again is much his junior. Actually, would he be his junior? He would be his junior. Not by that much, but yes, he is his junior. But he writes to Rav Shapira, Your Honor, you've already decided that she's allowed to stay married to her husband, and you went on at length with good explanations. You want to know my poor point of view. I don't see any need for you to consult with me. He says, the Chachma Yerushalayim are great, they don't need me. Who am I? Opposite you. So, like we said, he becomes a Ram in Merkaz Arav at the age of, well, in 1945. I'm not going to bother trying to figure out what his age was. Again, that's going to depend. Rav Yaakov Moshe Charlap becomes too ill to give shir at some point before 1951. Because 1951 was when Rav Charlap passed away. So, somewhere between 1945 and 1951, Rav Shapira begins giving the shir klali, the shir to the entire yeshiva. Rav Herzog appoints him to be a member of the Beit Din Rabbani of Yerushalayim in 1956. He actually refuses until Rav Elyashiv, who at the time was also on the Beit Din, this is before the whole falling out with Rav Gorin, so Rav Elyashiv pushes him to join the Beit Din, and that's why he joins. 1971, he becomes the Av Beit Din, the head of that Beit Din. 1974, he's appointed to the Beit Din HaRabbani HaGadol. Rav Mordechai Eliyahu was supposed to be the Av Beis Din. He had seniority on the court, but he insisted that Rav Shapira be the Av Beis Din instead. 1977, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, I'm just running through the bio quickly, but Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook appoints him to serve as Rosh Hashiva in Merkaz Harav along with Rav Tzvi Yehuda. In 1980, he's appointed to the Moetzet Rabbanut HaRashit B'Yisrael, the chief rabbinical council of the chief rabbinate. And in 1982, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook passes away, and he becomes Rosh Hashiva of Merkaz Harav alongside Rav Shaul Yisraeli. And he holds that position from 1982 until his passing in 2007. So for 25 years, he's the Rosh Yeshiva, aside from all the years when he just gave shir in the yeshiva. But in 1983, this goes back to your question, so when was he the chief rabbi? So there was a whole story. Originally, the position of chief rabbi was a life position. However, due to circumstances beyond the scope of the shir, the decision was made to limit it to 10 years. And this was at the time when Rav Avadya Yosef and Rav Gorin were the Rabbanut HaRashit. So in 1983, Rav Avadya and Rav Gorin are forced to step down. He, Rav Shapira, pushes for the law to be changed, for them to be allowed to continue. they are, in the end, the law stands, and therefore they have to step down. And at that point, he becomes the chief Ashkenazi rabbi. So from 1983 to 1992, he served as chief Ashkenazi rabbi of the state of Israel. Mordechai Eliyahu, who had been with him on that Beis Din years before, is the Sephardi chief rabbi of the time. So that's his main period as in terms of, you know, serving as chief rabbi, 1983 to 1993. When he finishes as the chief rabbi, he goes back to being Rashiv of Merkaz Arav. And he remains in that position. Again, he passes away on the first day of Sukkot in 2007. Like I said, the main sefer of his articles is this four-volume Minchas Avram. There are many other articles. There are many other books of his sichot. One is called Mor Rasha. Another one is called Eis L'chol Chayfetz. Another one is called Yom HaDerigla. There's a sefer called Rosh Devarecha, or Rosh Devarecha, which I've seen mentioned, but I can't find an actual copy of it. And it records stories of his life, supposedly. So that's a little bit of just facts in terms of his biography. He lived very simply. He lived in a small apartment in Geula while he was the Rav HaRashi. And then, when he stepped down from that, he went back to being a Merkaz HaRav. So he moved into a place in Kiryat Moshe, right near Merkaz HaRav. He's very known in particular for his kavana in tefillah. His kavana in tefillah and his kavana in brachos. Kavana in davening was very important to him. There's a story I saw referenced that Tzvi Yehuda Cook first became enamored of him when he saw the way he davened. That was what captured Tzvi Yehuda Cook about him. So I brought you a very interesting conversation here in number four. This is from that Mara Cohen website, where he's having an Ask the Rabbi session with yeshiva students. So he says to them in the beginning of the session, what you see here in number four. He says, "Kshani roeh etchem, when I see you, kach, ani nizkar shegam ani ayisi kmochem tzair." He says, "I remember, I used to be young like you." Atem yicholum tzair davar kaza. Can you imagine? Nir rachok, it appears very distant, very unlikely. The gil hazeh, but he says, at this age, yesh lechol echad koach miuchad shel tefila. At this age, you have a special power of davening. And if you could give me something from your age, titpalalu kodem kol lemanchem, daven, he says, first of all for yourselves, you'll never lose by davening for yourself, he says to the kids. And I ask of you, im tuchlu, if you could, Rosh Hashanah lihitpalil gamolai. He says, the chief rabbi, he says, on Rosh Hashanah, please daven for me. Shetvakshume amalachim gamla teitli mashuli. He says, ask the malachim to give me something too. Az ani yodelachem ma'od. I would be very grateful if you could do that. And then he says, "Mikayman shni modelachem." Since I'm grateful, haray ani chayav gamla aniklachem mashu. I have to give you something. Nu tishalu mashu. So he says, "Ask me questions, and I'll answer." And that's how he starts his Ask the Rabbi session with the school children, which I think speaks to his attitude to tefillah and also his sensitivity to the kids. Along the same lines, in terms of kavana, the Merkaz HaRav bio in number five says, Ba'osat Kufa, at that period in his life, towards the end of his life, Hayar Rabbeinu mitpalel b'mei ha'sha'arim. He used to daven in mei ha'sha'arim. Gamar Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kuk Zatzal haya mitpalel sham rabba. Oh, this is where I saw the reference to Rav Tzvi Yehuda. That Rav Tzvi Yehuda used to daven there as well. This isn't at the end of his life. This is earlier in his life, because Rav Tzvi Yehuda passed away in 82. But Rav Tzvi Yehuda used to daven there, and Rav Tzvi Yehuda Zatzal hitpa'el ma'od mitfilaser shel Rabbeinu. He is very taken by, energized by the tefillah of Rav Shapira. U'me'az nikshu shneim b'avoso shel Ava, and that's when he fell in love with him. That's when they started to bond. But then you get the story that I meant to bring you. He says, Koach tefillah miyuchad ayel Rabbeinu. Our master had a great power of tefillah. Ba'arba shnosav ha'acharonos. In the last 4 years of his life, hifsik lechol lechem bimos hachol. He stopped eating bread during the week. Not because of a special diet. He's going off of carbs. Rather, l'sheilat ha'rabbanit tichya, with the rabbanit asked him why he was doing this. Anash she'eno ochal lechem mishum shu margisha kavanah shelo b'birkat hamazon einena kamo pam. His answer was, he feels like his kavanah in benching isn't what it used to be. So because he couldn't have proper kavanah in benching, he decided, I'm not going to eat bread. That was his way of dealing with it. That's the kind of approach to tefillah that he had. we already saw some of his sensitivity in his approach to the school children. But I brought you in number 6 from another Ask the Rabbi session. He was asked how to deal with Jews who are not shomrei mitzvos, who do not keep the mitzvos. And his answer is really what you would expect from somebody in the line of Rav Kook from that school. He says, "Mamesh sha'alto sikzas berurim binyan zeshayachas legabe yudim she'enam shomrim Torah mitzvos." He says, "You asked me for clarification regarding Jews who are not observant of mitzvos." Zoi sugya kashomer kevet meod. He said, "This is a complicated and hard sugya." Yesh b'malachos gedolos shel Torah binyanim gedolim shel midat sablanut. He says, "There are major issues here in terms of the trait of patience, avas Yisrael, achdus Yisrael, love of Israel, unity of Israel, v'sanei goryal Yisrael, and defending Israel." Shehem heim gufei Torah kivshon shel olam mamash. He says, "That's the body of Torah." He says, "These are major principles within Torah." He says, "V'horah b'nyanim elu misur b'chol adoros l'rabbanim ha'me'uravim ha'tzibur v'nos'im b'ol ha'tzibur." He says, "You want to know who should paskin on these things? Shul rabbis. Rabbis who are involved with the community. L'rabbanim g'dolim ha'makirim b'chovei ador v'muchosav." You need great rabbis who know the pains of the generation, who know its causes of confusion. V'chaz v'shalom livater al kol shumei ha'Torah. He says, "God forbid, we're not going to give up on any element of Torah." Ve'ein le'uma rak emunas ha'Torah bilvad u'bishlemusav le'itachim le'tzamtzimah chaz v'shalom. He says, "All we have is our belief in the Torah and its completeness, and you cannot minimize that." Ela gam ze Torah. However, our approach to these Jews is also Torah. Eich mochichim, how to rebuke. Eich mekarvim, how to draw people close. Eich motziim yakar mizolal, how to bring something of value from something that is very cheap. Ve'eich misrachkim mepirud u'machlokes kechol ha'efshar, and how to stay away from division and strife as much as possible. He says that's Torah also. So I'm not giving up on Torah by saying that we should treat them carefully. This is also Torah. And he says, "Zu aisa avodas hakodesh hagdola Yisrael b'chol adoros." He says that was the holy work of the gedolim in all generations. Uba'aretz b'miuchad al yedei Rav Kook. That's all. He says, of course, in Israel, especially by Rav Kook, and he is the one whose footsteps we follow. L'karev es Yisrael beinam lebein asman beinam lebein avinu shebashamayim, to unite Jews with other Jews and to unite Jews with Hashem. B'miuchad gedola avoda zu achrei ha'shoah. And he says this is especially important after the Holocaust. V'achrei she'Hashem yizbarach hekim lanu es medinas Yisrael be'eretz ha'kodesh. And after Hashem established the Medina for us in our Holy Land. She'kama u'miskayem es gam'ata b'mesiris nevesh mamash ha'kol tzibur Yisrael. He says, why do we have the state? Because of the sacrifice of the entire community. Tzadikim beinonim u'rishayim. Everybody. V'gam'ata anuzikukim u'mesiris nefesh la'avdol u'shamran. It still needs our sacrifice to work the land and to protect it. And then he says, I realize this is a long quote, but I really like what he's doing here. He says, "Eretz Yisrael einena shtachim." He says, the land of Israel is not territories, the popular term used, right, for parts of the land to give back, not to give back. Ela eretz chemda. He says, this is a land of desire. Chemdat elyonim v'tachtonim k'lashon agra. As the Vilna Gaon said, it is the pleasure of, the desired item of the heavens above and the earth below. Umitzvah me'atara lahavzik boli yisyashim ba. He says, it is a mitzvah to hold on to the land and to settle there. We're going to talk more about that later. V'hi ma'aseh shamayim lahafiach ruach chayim ba'am sridei charb. He says, this nation, the state, is an act of Hashem to invest breath of life into the nation, the remnant of the sword. Every single one of the land's children has a hold on some mitzvahs of the Torah. He says it is the time for rebuke that comes from love, education that comes from love, drawing hearts closer together. And the obligation is to raise the unity of Israel, to strengthen people's tolerance for each other. The limud zchus, and teaching merit about each other. And he quotes you the story of Gidon, right? The story of Gidon in Sefer Shoftim, where the Malach comes to Gidon and says, "Hashem imcha gibor chayel, Hashem is with you, mighty warrior." And Gidon's response to him is, "Where have you been? all these miracles of Mitzrayim, where have they been? And the Medrash says on that, and that's what he's quoting here, Shalim Eitzchus Al Am Yisrael, that Pincha, that Gidon, tried to argue on behalf of the Jews. You know why we sinned? Because we haven't seen Hashem's hand. And he is praised for it. The Malach says to Gidon, go with exactly this energy and this strength that you have of defending Israel. V'itzalta es Yisrael, go save Israel. And he says, look in the Maseches Yesharim, he has more about being Malami Tzchus for Israel. And then he says, Hapirud b'Yisrael haya agorim lahemshach shibud Mitzrayim. Separation among Jews is, or between Jews, is what caused the slavery in Egypt to continue. And he quotes the classic Medrash about that, about how Moshe says, now I understand why we are in Mitzrayim, when he sees the two Jews fighting. And then the last paragraph, V'chol ha-doros, in all generations, V'chem b'doreinu, and in our generation, V'kach b'zman ha-melu, in our days, Ha-mivchana musarihu ha-koveya de'chut ha-chirut v'ha-geula. He says, the ethical level is what's going to establish the level of our freedom, the quality of our freedom and redemption. In biglal pirudim v'choser achdus v'yitzrim anochiyim mezazlim b'farhesia b'normot musariot mekubalot hagormot l'chilul Hashem. He says, if because of our divisions and lack of unity and our selfishness, that causes us to publicly degrade ethical norms, causing chilul Hashem, we go back to what Moshe said. That's why we haven't succeeded. And so he says we have to make sure to avoid that kind of intolerance and that kind of strife with each other. Interestingly, if you flip the page to number 7, you find an article from the paper Strugim, an online article, in which they say, and you should know, his tolerance was not only towards the left. Unfortunately, you find some people who are very tolerant of those who are more liberal than them, but not of those who are perceived as being more to the right of them. That's not so for him. He records a story in which a minister in the Knesset made an offer to Rav Shapira saying that he should cut all the budgets for all the yeshivot except for Merkaz Harav. Merkaz Harav and its satellite yeshivot will get money from the government and get rid of all the other ones. To which he responded, "Sha'anu nachriz she'elu yeshivot ve'elu lo." Should we declare that these are yeshivot and these are not yeshivot? He defended everybody. He wanted for everybody, and this despite his personal Zionism, which was very strong, as we are going to see. In the Hesped that I quoted in the beginning, they also comment that he had quite the sense of humor. I have to admit that the example that he brings doesn't really do it for me, but that's rabbi humor for you. The example they bring is that the fellow who is speaking, Rav Yitzchak Steinberg, I don't know which Rav Yitzchak Steinberg this is. I don't think it's the one I'm familiar with, but I don't know. But he says that when he was still a bachur, he had an issue where women from time to time wanted to shake his hand.
The encyclopedia Talmudit?
Right, so that's what I'm thinking about.
He's America's boy.
Yeah, but I don't think it's him giving the Hesped. He sounds very, very Anglo.
Oh.
And I don't think that's him. Rav Steinberg says when he was still single, he had issues where from time to time a woman wanted to shake his hand. And he went to Rav Shapira and asked, what should I do? And Rav Shapira's answer to him was, you should grow a beard. Then they won't want to shake your hand. All right, some people laughed. Some people find it funny. I didn't find it funny. Okay, fine. But that's a little bit about his personality. Okay, let's get into, though, his approach to halachic issues, and specifically the three areas that I wanted to focus on. The first is Mesorah. He's very concerned about Mesorah, and when I say he's concerned about Mesorah, what I mean by that is both for strict purposes and for leniencies. He's very against new chumros. He doesn't like the idea of people inventing new things that are going to call into question old practices that we've had. But he's also not a fan of leniencies that spring up, that are in violation of the Mesorah. He believes that the Mesorah itself is part of Torah. And if you take a look at source number 8, this is the very first article in the Michas Avram. He talks about how the Rambam, in his introduction to Mishneh Torah, includes a list of the Chachmei HaMesorah, the sages of our transmission of Torah. And he picks up on that and he says, you know, you want to know why that's there? Okay. It's there because it's part of Torah. He says in number 8, it's halacha. V'hine, ein kavanas HaRambam ma'akdama lichtov divrei hayamim. The Rambam is not simply giving you a record of history. The tradition itself, the transmission itself, is part of Torah and is a foundation of faith. You learn those names of who transmitted the Torah the same way that you learn other Divrei Torah. And he says it's not just the Rambam, it's the Ravid too. He says the fact that the Ravid needs to make seven different arguments with the Rambam about the introduction to Mishnah Torah is because he believes he's debating Torah. Just like when it comes to Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah, the Rambam goes on at length about what prophecy is, even though it's a work of law. All of that is part of Torah. And then he says something interesting. The Rambam opens his sefer with two psukim, and he only brings you here one of them. B'shem Hashem Kel Olam. In the name of God, Kel Olam. I used to think that the reason he does it is there was a practice in the Muslim world, Bism Allah, as the beginning of a book, and I thought maybe there was some kind of a connection between what the Rambam was doing. He says that's not what's going on. He says, where does this pasuk come from? Where's the pasuk from? B'shem Hashem Kel Olam. We have at least one Baal Kriya here. B'shem Hashem Kel Olam. The opening two words of it are Vayikra Sham. Vayikra Sham B'shem Hashem Kel Olam is Abraham. That's Abraham. So he says, not only does the Rambam begin Mishnah Torah with B'shem Hashem Kel Olam, but he says, if you look in the manuscripts, all his books, he starts with this pasuk. Perish HaMishnayos, the commentary to the Mishnah, his Sefer HaMitzvos, Morin Nevuchim, Pasuk Zeh Nemar Al Avram Avinu, Vayikra Sham B'shem Hashem Kel Olam. Right, there you go. Black and white. Parshas Vayera. Yesh machlokes beferusho. But there's a machlokes as to what it means. What does that mean? He called there in the name of Hashem, the eternal God. Mau vayikra. What do you mean? And he called even. B'targum unkulos mefarish hakavana letfila. So Targum unkulos says it means that Avram davened there. And that's how the Targum reads it. V'tzali Avraham, Avram davened. V'ilu harambam mazbir shezu Torah. The Rambam says no. It's Torah. He's teaching Torah. That's calling in the name of Hashem. It's teaching Torah. Such as the Rambam wrote in Hilchos Avodah Zarah, v'hischil lamod v'likro v'kol gadol l'chol ha'olam, that Avraham began calling out in a great voice to the world by a mahalech v'korei. He traveled around making this call, issuing this call. U'mekabeit ha'am me'ir le'ir mamlachal mamlacha. He gathered people from city to city, from nation to nation, achigil Eretz Canaan, until he arrives in Eretz Canaan v'hu korei. And he would call out what he was teaching them. Vayikra Hashem, B'shem Hashem, Kel Olam. So what's the Rambam doing by bringing this in the beginning of each sefer? What's his point? B'havaz pasuk zeh romez harambam she'im ki etzem matan Torah haya b'har Sinai yedei Moshe Rabbeinu abal or ha-Torah hischila ha'ir od kodem al yedei Avraham Avinu. His point is that Torah doesn't begin at Har Sinai. Torah begins with Avraham. It begins with Vayikra Hashem B'Shem Hashem Kel Olam. That's the start of Misavra. And now he goes to the other end. And he says, he brings, in the part that I skipped here, he brings the classic medrash that you can divide up the history of the world into three periods of 2,000 years each. The first 2,000 years are Tohu, that's emptiness, until you get to Abraham. The second period of 2,000 years is the 2,000 years of Torah. And he says regarding that, that's where we're up to here, the last paragraph of number 8, V'alpayim shanim elu, this intermediate set of 2,000 years, histaimu al piacheshbon b'siyum Torah Eretz Yisrael, concludes roughly the time when the Torah of Eretz Yisrael is concluded, meaning the sealing of Hatosefta v'Yerushalmi. That's roughly the end of that, of the year 4,000. Karov assumes man has man be Israel. I'm not sure that I retyped these. This wasn't cut and pasteable, so I have, clearly have a mistake there. But it's assumes something be Israel. Omnam kan mechadesh harambam sheim ki ein smuchim. But his point is, oh, you know what? I think it's man hasmicha be Israel. I believe that's what it is. Man hasmicha be Israel. You know that the smicha that we have today is not the smicha that once existed. Smicha was supposed to be teacher to student, going back to Moshe Rabbeinu. The Romans effectively put a stop to that. And so you have, in the time of the Gemara, an interruption of smicha. But he says, What the Rambam is doing here, when the Rambam lists all of the Chachmei Mesorah, and he continues past the time when Smicha halts, the Rambam is trying to say, Shem ki ein smuchim, aval yesh Chachmei Mesorah, that even if we lack Smicha, we still have the Chachamim of the Mesorah. Kol Chachmei HaGemara Shatorasam Nimsura B'Shas, all the Chachamim of the Gemara, whose Torah is conveyed in the Gemara, Avshlo Husmuchu, even if they don't have Smicha, Hem Chachmei HaMesorah, they are still the Chachamim of the Mesorah, Va'avzem Ipi Moshe Rabbeinu, Umipi HaGevura, and all of their Torah is the Torah of Moshe and of Hashem. So he says, the message that he wants to bring is that all of this counts as Mesorah, and all of it is part of Torah, and it is sacrosanct. And you see it in number 9. Number 9 is his tshuva on the status of the Ethiopians who came to Israel. You know the classic debate about the status of the Ethiopians. There were two questions, right? One question was, are they considered Jewish? Question number 2 is, if they are Jewish, are they mamzerim? Because they didn't have the Torah Shabbat Al-Peh that we were practicing from the Gemara, and they didn't do marriage and divorce the way that we do marriage and divorce. So maybe that undermines their legitimacy, and even if they are Jewish, maybe they are Mamzerim. And you know that in the 1950s, Rav Herzog said that they are not considered halachically Jewish. He thought he was doing them a favor. He said they should be brought to Israel. He wrote, bring them to Israel. However, they should have a giur. To be on the safe side, let's treat them as non-Jews, and that way you don't have any mamzer issues. Because a non-Jew can't be a mamzer. So that was Rav Herzog's approach. They end up coming in 1984, after Rav Ovadia Yosef says, actually no, we consider them Jewish. Gir Lachumra comes up just to be on the safe side, but he says they're considered Jewish. It's a whole other story in terms of why it took that long for them to actually arrive in Israel. That's its own discussion. But the point is this. 1984 is when Rav Shapira is now the chief rabbi. So they ask him his position on the status of the Ethiopian Jews. So he goes back to a key point, which is the Radbaz was asked about the Ethiopian Jews going back to the 16th century. The Radbaz was a rav in Spain. What contact did he have with Ethiopian Jews? Why was he paskening Ethiopian Jews?
He's on the port there.
And you're right.
The slaves, probably.
The slaves, correct. Two cases came to hand for the Radbaz involving slaves. The first one that's brought up there was an Ethiopian woman who claimed to be Jewish and claimed to have been married when she was in Ethiopia, and she was bought by a Jew. And the story was that had been a massacre and all the men had been killed, but there's no proof that her husband is dead. She ends up producing a child from the Jew who bought her. And the question is the child a mamzer? Because you don't have any edus that the original husband is in fact dead. That was the first question of the two that was put to the Radbaz. So the Radbaz says, these people are Jewish. We have a book, the Sefer Eldad Hadani, which claimed to document the status of the Jews of Dun and a few other Shvatim who had ended up in Ethiopia. And the Sefer Eldad Hadani says that this Edus was brought before Rav Tzemach Gaon, and that he certified that they were Jewish. And the Radbaz says, therefore, they are Jewish. So look at what the Minchas Avram has to say about this. Because all of the researchers, the scientists, look at this and say, in the 20th century, look at this and say, come on. Based on these fantastic accounts, I mean, Eldad Hadani, if you read the book, it's not a long book. It's fascinating reading, but you look at it and think, really? Do you believe that? He tells a story about how the days of Yeravam ben Nevat, Yeravam is breaking away, the north from the south. He wants there to be a war between the north and the south. And Dun was a mighty Shevet, and they knew that he was going to want to call upon them to fight the south. And Eldad Hadani says, I don't want to be, Eldad says, the Shevet Dun doesn't want to be brought into it. And so, first they want to fight against Yeravam ben Nevat, but they end up leaving, and they're going to go towards Mitzrayim, but they said we can't go to Mitzrayim because the Torah says you never return to Mitzrayim. So instead they go to Cush, they go off to Ethiopia, and then other Shvatim end up there as well. That's Eldad Hadani's account of it. So the social scientists and the researchers of the 20th century look at this and they say, really? I mean, can you really think that that's where they came from? So look at what Rav Shapiro writes in number 9. He says, "Hachlatot Rabbanut HaRashit." He says the decisions made by the chief rabbinate, "Einan mistamchot amamarim u'mechkarim shel chokrim," don't rely on the positions and researches done by these scholars. "V'afilu taraniim," I don't care if they're shomrei mitzvahs, they're not coming at it from our perspective. Or rabbaniim, even if they're rabbinic. "El al dvarim shel piskei halacha," we're concerned about psak. "Piskei halacha l'maisel shorabo seinu poskei halachos liYisrael," we go back to those who have given halachic rulings for us. "Heim heim amuda yisod shal pihem anachnu chayim uposkim halachos l'maisel ledoros." Those are the pillars of our tradition. That's how we decide halacha. "Biluk sav macherim him begeder hasharot." Anything else is guesswork. It actually shades of, we did this here when we did our series on modern halachic issues. We talked about tcheles. So the Minchas Asher, his stance on the discoveries of Tchelis is actually very reminiscent of this. He says, everything else that you're going to tell me is a guess. So he says, "Rabboseinu HaKadmonim, b'shosh hakodesh v'pisken halachos, aleihem nemar b'chazal harishonim kemalachim." He says, our masters, when they write Pesach Halacha, that's what they're referring to in the Gemara when they say the earlier ones were like Malachim. "V'ruach HaKodesh ha'isashora aleihem oz," they had Ruach HaKodesh, "v'hem nichtu v'nishru ledoros, harei ze'oz nosaf l'siyata d'shmaya shakol posek zakukla." And if they were written down, and they remained all this time, hundreds and hundreds of years, that's a sign that Hashem supports this. So he says, "Me'akadmonim shakaswa inyan Yehuda Ethiopia, kipsak halacha im haradbaz, v'talmidom areinu Rav Kashtro." He says, the Radbaz was one of those early ones who wrote about this. Radbaz b'tshuvosav dot dot dot. He gives you some of the storyline. "Ubesoch dvarav kasav she'elu abam me'eretz kush he'misheva don b'li safek." He wasn't uncertain. "Umishum shalu hayu b'neim chachamim b'alei kabbalah tafsu lahem." Oh, shalom. It should be shalom with an aleph. "Umishum shalu hayu b'neim chachamim b'alei kabbalah." And because these people in Ethiopia didn't have the tradition, they had broken off too early. So therefore, they in some ways looked like Karaites. So he says, "Ein b'kavach rabbanei dorenu lidchos psak halacha shepasak harabah shegodol ador." He says, you can't counter a psaka the Radbaz. "Ubein talmido hamafursamim hayu ari hakadosh v'tal ashkenazi." He says, you know who his talmidim were? The ari on the one side, v'tal ashkenazi, author of the Shita Mekubetzes, on the other side. "V'haya migdoli hameshiv mechol adaros." He says, this is one of the great halachic authorities. "Meim avanu shosim, we drink his water. Ubein shawal av nimnu rabbasenu beis Yosef, mabit, maribal, rashdam, v'od yole adaros." He says, you want to know who asked him questions? Rav Yosef Karo asked him questions. So how can you doubt him? "V'hinei radvaz kosef shehem yehudim b'li safek v'anan neim hashem lo yehudim asmaha." He says, it's shocking. How could you think to question? That's his position. You want to know his derech hapsak. Misora is a very clear anchor for him. And you see it in his approach to questions. When you read through Minchas Avram, it's a hard read. Right? In the last mini-series I did Rav Unterman. Rav Unterman is a breeze. Meaning, unless you're reading his longer articles, Be'inyan, something like his articles on Pikuach Nefesh, but if you read his Tshuvos, they're an easy read. When you deal with Rav Shapira, his Tshuvos are working his way through the sugyas, working his way through the makaros. He stays away from metahalachic ideas, for the most part. He stays away from dramatic proclamations, for the most part. He believes there's a halachic process, and that's what you have to follow. I'll give you a great example in number 11. I actually decided to translate this for Truman. The number 10 is just more to the point about relying on the Radbaz. I'm not sure why I needed to add that line. He's just writing, right, because he had been challenged, saying, well, they don't really seem to have much Torah. They don't have the Torah Shebaal Peh. He says, yeah, the Radbaz knew that too. And that didn't lead him to challenge their status as Jews. So I'm good with it. But in number 11, this is part of an interview with Rav Shapira that was published in the journal Tchumen. And he was asked about how you can bring the Geula. How can you bring the Beis HaMikdash? So the first half of it is interesting. I don't think I really needed to bring it here, but the first half is very interesting in and of itself, where he talks about the love of the Beis HaMikdash. He talks about how the Ma'aril Diskin had a window out of his apartment where you could see the Har HaBayis, and the doctors wanted the Ma'aril Diskin to move out of the apartment, because every time he looked out the window, he would start crying, and they were worried for his health. And then he talks about how before the Six-Day War, on Yantif, the Rashi Yeshiva and the Talmidim from the Yeshiva would go to a place called Musrara, which at the time when I made up the story sheet, I didn't know where it was. But then I looked it up, and it flanks the area of the old city. And he said, we used to go there to look out at Har HaBayit in order to awaken our longing for the Beis HaMikdash. This is part of his identity, this longing for the Beis HaMikdash. So then someone asks him, and what about Karbanos? So he talks about the importance of Karbanos, the importance of restoring the Karbanos, and then you get to the piece that I really wanted you to see in number 11. He has a story from the Abda Rav. The Abda Rav's story is that a Jew comes to the Abda Rav, and he's talking about all of his problems. He's crying about all of his problems, and the Abda Rav comforts him, and he encourages him. And then he says to him, you know, a great tragedy happened for the Jewish people today. And the Jew, who's consulting the Abda Rav, says, what happened? And he says, we didn't bring the carbon tamid today. That is a tragedy. So coming from that perspective, and I emphasize it, I think that's why I brought the whole piece before it, what you see is somebody who clearly longs for a Beis HaMikdash, for Karbanos, and he's about to be asked the question, so should we go up onto Har HaBayit? That's the question that they're driving at. And he says, the top of the next page, Im kol zos, nonetheless, yesh lanu izaher b'mor ha-mikdash, we have to be careful for reverence for the Beis HaMikdash. Ha-kisufim le-binyan ha-bayis hem ritsuyim v'amitiyim. He says, our longing to build the Beis HaMikdash is desirable and it's authentic. But asur lanu lefrotz gidrei halacha kadei lebatei osam kisufim. You can't break through the boundaries of halacha because you want to express your longing. It's too late. The psak is, we are tamei meis. We can't go there. And the last words of the sentence are the key. Ve'ein ava soseres shuras ha-halacha. From a Shapira's perspective, love doesn't override the halachic process. Others have disagreed. I'm familiar with one Rav who said, you know, if we don't go on to Har HaBayit, then we're ceding it to the Arabs. They'll say, look, the Jews don't even want to go there. So we need to go to make a stand. That's not a halachic statement. It may be a value, and it may be important in your calculation, but it's not in and of itself a halachic statement. And if the Arabs have control of Har HaBayit, I mean, at this point in our halachic lives, if you don't believe that we're able to build a Beis HaMikdash, so they have it. He says it doesn't work that way. Sorry?
Diane gave it to them.
That's in its own story. But he says the fact that we love it doesn't mean that that we subvert halacha. That's his argument. That's pillar number one that I see here is the respect for the Mesorah and the halachic process above all. Second, the importance of Eretz Yisrael. He was a real serious ardent Zionist with very strong halachic positions regarding the significance of the land of Israel. He took up the mantle of Reb Tzvi Yehuda. Reb Tzvi Yehuda passed away in 1982 during the crisis in Yamit. And Reb Tzvi Yehuda had insisted that we could not give up any part of Yamit, and he took up the mantle on that, and he made a push for refusal of orders for evacuating Jews, just like the position of Reb Tzvi Yehuda was back in Yamit. During the evacuation of Amona in 2006, Rav Shapira refused to give shir klali in yeshiva. He said, "Am Yisrael is bitzara. I can't give shir." Nonetheless, he insisted on retaining the prayer for the Medina. He said, "Halal on Heir." He still maintained the greatness of having Hashem having given us a state. But he said, all of this comes from, and this is what I brought you in number 12, the idea that there is a duty for all Jews to live in Israel today. The classic question, is there a mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael? And if there is a mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, is it chiyuvi or kiyumit? right? Is it a mitzvah which you are obligated to perform, or is it if you do it, you get merit? So he thought that was a terrible, terrible question. He says, first of all, in number 12, recognizing we're short on time, I'm going to say it outside of what you have here on the page, but you can see it there. He says, first of all, there's no such thing, as far as he's concerned, as a mitzvah kiyumit, a mitzvah that gives you schar if you do it, but it's okay to skip it. He doesn't believe in such things. He says, sure, tzitzis is a mitzvah kiyumit in the sense that you could choose not to have a garment of four corners. But if you have a garment of four corners, you have to put tzitzis on it. He says, same thing is true here. He says, there's no such thing as saying you get merit for going to Israel, but you don't have to go. He says, the definition of mitzvah is a command. And if it's a command, you don't get to choose whether you're going to follow it or not. That's number one. And then he says, and this I love, you have to see this, in the second paragraph of number 12. And he says, Val karchach l'ramban, shesover shavi mitzvah saseh mitarag mitzvah. He says, the Ramban thinks it's one of the tarag mitzvahs. Right? Because the Pasuk says, you'll settle the land. And he says in parentheses, Beinim HaRambam Sover Kein Olal. Yeah, there's a classic debate. Why didn't the Rambam count it in the 613? He says, I don't care whether the Rambam believes it is or isn't. This is one of the 613. And he says, of course it is. And then he addresses the question. So why didn't the Gedolim always go to make Aliyah? If it's really one of the 613, why didn't they all live there? And his answer is, because they were anus. They couldn't live there. But he says, you have to know what ones means. Ones doesn't mean it's a threat to their lives. That's not what ones means. He says, living in Israel is like the mitzvah of living in a sukkah. Which is to say, you have to live there the way you would live normally. If you can't live there the way that you would live normally, you're mitzta'er, then you're pater, then you're exempt. So that's why they didn't do it. However, he says, that's no longer true in our day. In our day, you can live here in the country, you have economic conditions in which everybody is able to live there and they can do just fine. That's his argument. And therefore, he says, there is a duty for all Jews to live in the land of Israel. He says, this is very clear. And so he dealt with mitzvos hatzlios ba'aretz, the mitzvos of the land of Israel, in a very practical way. He went to visit the greenhouses to rule on them regarding Shemitah. He was very unhappy with the Heter Mechira. I brought this for you in number 13. He didn't like the Heter Mechira, where you sell the land of Israel in order to be able to have it farmed in certain ways during Shemitah. But he says, you need it for now. He brings ideas for how to avoid having to use it in the future. He's hoping that it will not be necessary ultimately. But he says, right now, this is what we need. And therefore, this is what we ought to do. He said, he quotes you the Aderet, I think it was the Aderet, who said when he didn't live in Israel, he was against it. Then he got there and he realized, no, this is necessary. He says that we do it. And because of this point of view, that a Jew must live there, that the land is so important, that's what leads to his stance on disengagement. In number 14, you get his psak, pieces of his psak on the disengagement from Aza. And if you just take a look quickly through some of it, it's in English, so it'll go quickly. He says, according to Torah law, it is completely forbidden to give land in Israel to a non-Jew. The prohibition of lo techanim. You are not allowed to give them a share in the land. So you can't give them Aza. And he said it applies to every Jew, soldier and civilian alike. In order to take part in the evacuation of Jews from their homes to give land to non-Jews is an order that is against the religion of our holy Torah and forbidden to fulfill. In part B, he says, the prohibition of handing land over to non-Jews includes helping those engaged in the transgression. One must not participate in blocking the entrances to Gush Katif or assist in any other manner the expulsion of Jews from their homes. Similarly, it is upon every soldier called for reserve duty to refrain from showing up if his service is designated to enable other soldiers to take part in the transgression. I skipped a bunch. And then he says, it is incumbent upon every Jew to do all he can to stop transgression. Every single Jew is required to protest. Of course, the use of violent means against soldiers of the IDF or the Israeli police is not permitted. And then he goes on to say, you have to be a serious posig to rule on these matters. You can't just be anybody in order to rule. This is part of his stance as a believer in the Kedusha and the sanctity of the land. In number 15, I brought you, there's an exchange of letters in the journal tradition between Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Avram Silvetsky, who was the son-in-law of Rav Shapiro, and he answers on his behalf. And Rav Lichtenstein quotes the position of the Rav, that you can give back land in a case of pikuach nefesh. So take a look in Rav Silvetsky, number 15, toward the bottom of the page. He says, I unabashedly admit that owing to my deficiency, I don't fully understand the position that Kvod Torato Shlita cites in the name of Agon Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik Zatzal, that there is no prohibition to hand over portions of the land of Israel in a situation of pikuach nefesh, that is to say, in a situation of danger to individuals. He says, I don't understand what you're talking about. You telling me that for pikuach nefesh you can give up land? He says, I assume that after the fact, even Kvod Torato is happy that at critical junctures in the history of Zionism, this position was not accepted. The rejection of the Uganda plan, declaration of the establishment of the state, continued occupation of certain areas during the Six-Day War, putting our soldiers in danger, right? He says, look, if we had followed the Rav's position all along, that for pikuach nefesh we're going to give up land, you wouldn't have a state of Israel today. I think you're probably happy that they didn't follow that position all along. It's very sharp. But that's that's the second pillar. Finally, the third pillar, and there's a lot here to see. If you read through it, you'll see it. But the third pillar was just something that I found fascinating. And this is part of his tshuva on the status of the Olim from Ethiopia. The question that he's addressing here is the status of their bris mila. Because initially there was a move to require hatafas dam bris. They had a bris in Ethiopia. They're doing bris mila. And they're doing it fully. Bris mila with priya and everything. Nonetheless, there was a move to say, when they come to Israel, the Shem HaTafas Dam Bris, take a drop of blood. That'll be L'Shem Gerus for them. And he argued that it was not necessary, because the meal they had in Ethiopia was for the sake of entering the Bris of Avram Avinu. So therefore, you don't need to do anything additional. And indeed, Shmuel Salant and Tzipesach Frank, they took that position. Those are big names. But then he addresses the question, maybe the Moel isn't Jewish. In other words, we have a suffix. We have a suffix about them themselves. Maybe they're not Jewish. Not because the Radvaz is wrong. The Radvaz is right. But because over the centuries, people joined in and didn't have a proper gerus. So maybe the person who's getting the bris really wasn't halachically Jewish and needed to convert. And maybe the mole isn't Jewish. And the rule is that somebody who does not have a mila cannot do bris mila. So therefore, the Moel, who may have a Mila, but isn't Jewish, shouldn't be able to do the Mila. So first of all, he says it's very unlikely that both the Moel and the Nimol are not Jewish. That's number one. He says, what are the odds? Number two, he says, you can make the argument that a non-Jew can do Hatafas Dam. They may be able to do the taking of blood, and maybe therefore this will count. But he also notes that here the Moel himself has the Bris Mila, and therefore he may not count as an Arel. And he quotes you Gemara Yevamos Ayin Aleph, which says that if somebody has started the process of conversion, if somebody has a Bris Mila for Gerus, but he hasn't yet formally done Kabbalas Mitzvos, then he's not called an Arel anymore. And he may not be disqualified from doing Bris Mila. And he goes into a discussion of that point using the sources that I brought you here in 17 to 21, which, because I have to get somebody who's coming into the airport, I have to be very brief here. But he says, look, the person who's doing the Bris in Ethiopia believes he's Jewish. He believes he's doing a mitzvah. Even if he's wrong, his Mila is kosher, because, as the Rambam writes in number 17, a non-Jew is allowed to accept any mitzvah. And when he does, it's a valid mitzvah. The only exception is Shabbos. But other than that, a non-Jew...
Moses' wife performed...
Right, but that's before Matan Torah. She does that before Matan Torah, so maybe that won't, that may not count. But he says no. He says the non-Jew who does Bris Mila, doing it as a mitzvah, is a non-Jew who has accepted the mitzvah. The Rambam similarly writes regarding Netta Revai, that if a non-Jew dedicates it, then it has Kedusha, it has holiness to it. So he says, the non-Jew is able to accept the mitzvah. Actually, did I bring it for you? Yeah, I brought it for you, a number 20. that the Akum can do, net derivai. And he says, therefore, the non-Jew who did the Mila in Ethiopia for them was doing it as a mitzvah, and therefore it counts. And that's how he got his Mila himself, and therefore it counted for him as well. He's not called an RL, and therefore the Mila they had in Ethiopia is fine. It's a very creative type of a read. I haven't seen this argument made elsewhere. I could just be uninformed. But I didn't see others present this argument, and I thought that it was very interesting. So he has an element of creativity, but always marching through the sources, going through the sugya, and not taking shortcuts along the way. So I hope this was a helpful introduction to the thought of Rav Shapira. Clearly there's a lot more to be said at some other time. Thank you very much.